Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Legal Ops Podcast, where we talk about everything legal operations, legal business, and legal technology. My name's Alex Rosenrauch.
And I'm Elliot Liebhew. In this episode, we're going to talk about the ACC Legal Operations Maturity Benchmarking Report, which was released a few weeks ago at the time of recording, so in late April 2020. It's a report on the performance of a number of large in-house legal departments across 15 different core functions of legal operations. Alex, do you want to take us through how we're going to cover the report?
Yeah. Look, the report is quite large. It's 88 pages. So what we're going to try to do is distill, I think, what we consider is the most important. But basically what we'll do is we'll do an introduction to the report. So what it is, who participated, the different regions. We'll then provide an overview of the results for each function, or I like to consider almost like capabilities. We'll do a deep dive into some of the specific functions. We'll then have a discussion about what they consider, what the ACC consider as the best-in-class legal department profile and what that looks like. And then we'll finish with our key survey takeaways.
And we should say, actually, that everyone listening can get the report themselves, and we'll put a link in the show notes. And it's well worth looking at the report yourself, because there's a lot of detail that we won't have time to go through. Should we start with a background to the report itself and, you know, how many responses they had and that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So as we just discussed, the report was published by the Association of Corporate Counsel, the Global Association of Corporate Counsel, in partnership with Wolters Kluwer and Regulatory at the end of April 2020. It details in-house legal departments' performance on 15 different core functions and 92 related sub-functions. The purpose of the report was to determine where legal departments stand in terms of legal operations maturity based on their operations maturity model, which is, I guess, comparable to the CLOC maturity model if you've seen those. It's a very comprehensive study and includes responses from 316 legal departments across 29 countries and 24 industries, with organizations that range from, you know, millions to tens of billions of US dollars in company revenue. And also includes, you know, smaller teams like one lawyer departments, as well as departments that go up to 100, 300 departments. Like I said earlier, it's a massive report, 88 pages, lots of really, really good content. We're obviously not going to go through every single piece of content, but like you said, easiest way to download this document or report, I should say, is to go to www.acc.com and then search for, it's called the 2020 Legal Operations Maturity Benchmarking Report. That's a lot of words.
It is. Now, we should probably start, I think, by outlining the ACC Legal Operations Maturity Model, because the measures that they're looking at to assess legal ops maturity in the report align to that maturity model. So I think it's worth starting by just outlining what the different functions or the different components of that model are, and I'll do this quite quickly. So we've got change management, we've got compliance, which is interesting. I'll circle back to that one. Contract management, e-discovery and litigation, external resource management, so vendor management, financial management, you know, budgets, forecasting, etc. Information governance, so records management, innovation management, which I imagine is a process for both kind of surfacing innovative ideas, but also all the governance that would go around putting them into practice, intellectual property management, internal resource management, so recruiting, training, work allocation, performance management, talent development, all that kind of stuff, knowledge management, metrics and analysis, process and project management, which you might argue could be part of innovation management, actually. Strategic management, so I imagine that's, you know, kind of setting strategy and planning and that kind of thing for the department, and technology management. So again, I imagine that's the sort of tech roadmap and that kind of thing. Now, I said I wanted to circle back to compliance, and my question here is does compliance actually belong in the list? I wonder if is that really a legal ops activity? And I mean, I know there's no sort of, you know, correct answer to that question, but I'll say that in the organization that I work for, as I think is true in most large organizations, there's a compliance function which is completely separate to the legal department. So I wonder, Alex, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, just to be clear, I just want to read their definition of compliance, because I think different people would have different ranges of definitions. So from the ACC, compliance is defined as a set of activities to ensure organizational awareness of an adherence to rules and regulations in all jurisdictions in which the enterprise does business. So I know your point is around, you know, is compliance itself a role of the function? I mean, is there not an argument to say that that is almost the only role of a legal function?
Okay. We could probably do a whole episode on the philosophy and taxonomy and definitions of a compliance function versus a legal function. And I'm not sure that I'm sufficiently expert to actually lead that discussion. But I think what you've just described aligns quite closely in my mind anyway to what a compliance function does. And what I would say is that I think in organizations that have a separation between compliance and legal, the way that separation is structured is that compliance is more about sort of process and in some organizations, relationships with regulators. And legal is more about what do the laws and regulations actually say. So in other words, legal is about what are the obligations. Compliance is about how do we structure our business to make sure that we comply with them. But anyway, I do think that this is probably a whole conversation unto itself. The other thing I'll just mention here, and we'll circle back to this, is that the report goes into differences in maturity across different parts of the model between large organizations, so that's organizations with more than $1 billion in revenue, versus smaller organizations, so organizations with less than $1 billion in revenue. And there is a difference between the number of organizations in the large category that report compliance being relevant to the legal function, and then also the report of maturity. So to cut that sort of, or to summarize that a little more neatly, in larger organizations, the legal department reports, or the people completing the survey report, that compliance is part of the function at a slightly lower rate, and they report a higher maturity, which I think kind of makes sense. If you've got a dedicated compliance function, you would expect and hope that it's more mature.
Right, yeah. And I mean, just maybe to explain some of those statistics that you're talking about, when the respondents indicated, well, I guess we're responding to this survey, they would also have to indicate whether it was applicable to their function. So some legal departments say compliance is managed perhaps by the compliance department. Your point is that for companies that did indicate that compliance was applicable to them, they showed maturity. Is that what you're saying?
In this category, yeah, in relation to compliance, that's right. Yes. Now the other thing I thought it's worth mentioning is a brief comparison to the CLOCK legal ops maturity model, because I think that's one that people would know very well and is a sort of rich source of comparison. And what I would say, looking at the ACC legal ops maturity model and comparing it to the CLOCK legal ops maturity model, I've got a few sort of high-level points. One is that the CLOCK maturity model seems to have broader categories. And I will say actually that CLOCK have relatively recently updated their model, and I think some of those categories became broader in the update. But certainly, yeah, they have broader categories. So for example, the CLOCK maturity model does not include change management, whereas the ACC one does. Now, it's quite possible that CLOCK would consider change management to fall within one of the categories they do name. CLOCK includes training and development, which is actually an example of where CLOCK is narrower, I think. So it sort of runs counter to what I said, but it's one of the few examples where the CLOCK model is narrower, because the ACC's equivalent category is internal resource management, which is training and development and other stuff. And the CLOCK model does not include, at least as a named category, e-discovery and litigation. And again, that may well be covered in one of the broader categories. So I think that's just an interesting point of comparison there.
Yeah. And I guess another point of comparison is, I think CLOCK refer to them as competencies, which I'd probably lean towards as opposed to functions. I mean, I don't think if you look at this, a legal operations team would have a particular person looking after each one of these functions, I guess you could say. But I think the word function and capability or what was the other word that I said? Competency is going to be used interchangeably. I think I'll kind of switch between the two.
Yeah, agreed. All right, so should we jump in and talk about the measurement model?
Yeah. So I think before we do that, it's good just to understand where these numbers are coming from when we start talking about averages. So just if you weren't a part of the actual survey, just to explain that. So legal departments were asked to rate their current level of maturity using a fairly simple scale. It was a scale from 1 to 6 and then also a non-applicable. So 1 would be early stage, 2 would be early stage, but transitioning to intermediate stage. And then 3 would be the same. And then 5 would be advanced and so on and so forth. So when you're, I guess, responding to these functions and responding to these questions for both the core 15, but then the sub 92, you'd be answering in, you know, 1 to kind of 6. So let's jump into the overall results. I had some initial thoughts before we dive into them. And my initial thoughts are that the highest average score for any of the competencies was 3.46, which is intermediate stage 1. And that was for compliance, the one that we've been talking about. And I mentioned this before, but do we find it strange that the average legal department rates their maturity as intermediate stage 1, I guess, for a function that is core to what they do? I just found that quite interesting. Any thoughts on that, Elliot?
Yeah. I suppose there's a couple of things potentially going on here. If you look at all of the functions that were highest ranked, they were, as you said, compliance, but also financial management and information governance. And I'd make a similar comment to what I made earlier, which is that often these functions sit outside legal. And so to some degree, it doesn't surprise me that these were the highest ranked. But you're making a slightly different point, which is that although they may be the highest ranked, the overall highest ranking didn't seem that high. So out of a possible, you know, 6, we've got a highest ranking of 3.46, so just over halfway. I mean, the only thing I suppose I would suggest there is that if it's mostly lawyers completing this survey, and we don't actually know if it is lawyers, we don't know if it's lawyers or other people in a legal department, or in fact, even if it's people in a legal department, but it's probably safe to assume that it is. You know, I think we have a tendency to be hard on ourselves, essentially. So I think that there's something there, something going on there. And the other thing I'd say, if you look at the bottom end of the scale, so e-discovery and litigation management was the second lowest ahead of innovation management. And I find that a little bit surprising. You'd think that legal departments would be a bit more positive about their ability to manage litigation. So again, I think it probably circles back to the sort of, you know, somewhat pessimistic attitude or risk aversion or whatever you want to call it that I think can be in the legal way of thinking. Maybe I'm being too hard on lawyers there. I don't know. What do you think?
I think there are definitely personalities I guess relate to what it means to be a successful lawyer. That would mean that you could be semi-pessimistic or something like that. But my thinking around the intermediate stage, I mean, if I think about this objectively, if your CFO or CEO kind of, you know, sat you down and said, how competent do you think you are in compliance? And you said intermediate, I don't know if that's a great response. Like, obviously this is an average and there are teams that are going to excel, but that also means there are teams that think they're not doing a very good job at compliance, which I think is a fairly big issue. But anyway, I also found it quite interesting that 12 out of the 15 average maturity rates also fall within the intermediate stage, and the remaining kind of fall into that early stage. So there was no averages anywhere above the intermediate stage. So from a legal operations perspective, everybody considers themselves maximum intermediate. Which is very interesting from my perspective.
Yeah, I suppose the the other way to look at this, and this is sort of coming at it from a more positive and a less pessimistic perspective, and that is that legal operations is still relatively new. And I think there's a recognition by pretty much everyone involved that we all have a long way to go and the future is bright and we're on the path to get there. So, you know, I think you hear about a lot of other organizations that you may think are more mature than yours, and it feels like you know, there's a lot that can be done, which I think is an opportunity. So if you see opportunity, then you may think that your current ranking in a particular competency, you know, has room to grow.
Yep. No, I agree with that. I agree with that. But one other point I'd probably make is that when you look at the list, change management, compliance, contract management, intellectual property management, metrics and analytics, you know, all of these things should be what a well-functioning business unit does, regardless of it being legal. So the fact that legal operations is a new thing doesn't mean that the in-house team shouldn't have been thinking about internal resource management or anything like that. I think the ones that are new, which is where you get people that have worked outside of the industry kind of come in to the legal industry that do legal ops, is like change management, technology management. That's a big thing now with the, you know, introduction of a lot of new technologies, innovation management. Innovation hasn't really been a thing. There was been no economic reason almost in the legal industry to innovate until now. So I think it's two part. One is there's a lot of stuff that the team would have been doing, legal department would have been doing, but perhaps not so well, that has now been branded legal ops. And there's also new competencies that are legal ops. And the ACC kind of considered these 15 functions as those. So just talking about legal operations actually, and to talking about some of those categories that I think legal operations people can have a huge impact on. When you look at the study and kind of ask the question, the ACC asks this question, how does the average maturity rate change when an organization has at least one legal ops professional? And the answer is quite significantly. It had a net positive impact on all functions with an average 8-point increase, which is quite a lot. I mean, that's moving almost an entire stage. So for me, when I was reading this, some standouts, compliance, we've already spoken about that, an increase from intermediate stage one to intermediate stage two. So what I'm comparing there is basically in-house teams that don't have at least one legal ops person with teams that do. Financial management, technology management, strategic planning, and change management. And I guess the reason why I wanted to call these out is because, like I said, if we're bringing people with competencies outside of the legal industry, so not specifically lawyers, but have done other things, then they're going to bring across unique perspectives and unique skills. So financial management, for instance, I know there's a lot of people that work in legal ops teams that aren't lawyers, but have worked in finance teams before. You know, technology management. So you've got technologists that aren't, again, lawyers, but are rolling out technology just the same as the IT functions have done that in the past. Finance functions have done that in the past. Strategic planning. I don't think that's new at all, maybe new to the legal team. And then and change management kind of says it, or change management, we've been talking about that for a very long time. But I'm sure we're preaching to the choir, and I know, Elliot, you would know, but it's clear that having at least one legal ops professional has a significant impact on the operational maturity of a department.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing I'd say is that simply having a person focus on some of this stuff is going to make a big difference compared to not having a person focus on this stuff. So I think that's kind of one thing, just having staff and resource dedicated to this. You know, you think about things like financial management, technology management, strategic planning, as you mentioned, change management. All of those things in particular, again, just having a resource dedicated to it who can actually put the time into thinking about it and doing it is just a significant difference compared to not having that. And then, of course, circling back to a point I made earlier, we don't know who has completed the survey. So there is a question here, is that if it's mostly legal ops people, well, maybe it's sort of good that legal ops people would think that, you know, things are more mature when they have a legal ops team. So, you know, maybe there's a bit of positivity there actually. And well, the other word I could use is bias, but we don't know. We don't know who it is. Yes, that's right.
Well, maybe if the people that are listening, if you're reading this report, just have a think about how subjective versus objective some of these questions can be. Because that's what I did. I kind of went into this thinking as well. You might have a GC filling this out. You might have a legal ops person. You might have administrative support, whoever's doing it, because some of the questions are objective. Do you or do you not have a technology roadmap for the next 5 years? That's a pretty factual, objective question. Whereas there are some questions that are innately subjective, and I think you could rate yourself on a spectrum based on, well, if I consider this and I consider that and I consider this, you might get a different output. So I definitely get your point. So maybe let's preface some of the discussions that we're going to have further on with, there is going to be a mix of both subjective and objective questions.
Yeah, agreed. Now, the report also talked about which industries perform differently to which other industries. And I think it's worth saying here that, and it's probably not that surprising, legal departments in banking and finance seem to be sort of leading the charge in financial management, perhaps not surprisingly, given that it's what they do. And insurance wasn't far behind, and then not far behind that was insurance was behind that, but was leading in technology management, which is interesting. So insurance leading in technology management, banking and finance leading in financial management. And in fact, looking across the numbers generally, banking and finance and insurance seem to be more advanced than other industries. And, you know, I do think it's interesting. What do we think is going on here? And I'll say that, as I just mentioned, I think it sort of makes some sense that banking, finance, and insurance would be leading in financial management, given that it's what they do. But also, banking, finance, and insurance generally are large and well-resourced organizations. And in fact, the report did find a relationship between company size and maturity, and we'll come to that in a minute as well. And then the other thing I'd say is that banking, finance, and insurance are in highly regulated industries where compliance is very important. And we've already said that compliance was the highest rated discipline, competency, whatever we want to call it, across all of them. And I think to some degree, you've got compliance being rated almost as a, not an outlier, but significantly higher than some of the other measures, and particularly by banking, finance, and insurance companies. So in a way, I think you have compliance, which they have a lot of incentive to do well at, bringing their average results up. Any thoughts on that, Alex?
Look, I agree with your point. And I mean, there's lots of research that suggests that, you know, banking and finance, generally the revenue of the company is going to be higher, so kind of more than that $1 billion US. But also with that comes a lot of regulation and compliance, so you're going to have larger teams. And we'll talk about this a little bit more towards the end, but there is a relationship between the size of the company, the size of the team, and then also the size of the spend in relation to how mature operationally your team could be. What I found interesting is insurance, though. So insurance leading the charge on technology management. And perhaps that relates directly to the type of work that is performed in insurance. So maybe it's a high volume, low risk kind of work. So then they would have almost the economic reason to invest into technology. But it's, yeah, like you said, no surprise to me that banking and finance would be leading the charge on financial management.
Yeah. Interestingly, when you look at the results across different industries, there's sort of a top tier, I suppose you might say, which is banking, finance, and insurance in terms of how, you know, highly rated they are across all the competencies. And then there's almost like a kind of a next tier, which is companies doing very well on average as well across, you know, all the competencies. And that includes information technology, e-commerce, and manufacturing. They're kind of just behind, just the pack behind. And just a side point, which is that, you know, information technology seems to have been the kind of, proving ground for a lot of legal ops people. You know, we've had a number of guests on this podcast who have sort of grown up in their roles in information technology providers. So I would expect infotech companies to have mature or more mature legal ops functions. And I think that's definitely true. And I think it's probably for the reasons that we've discussed that they're not quite in that top tier. It's probably a scale issue more than anything else. That would be my guess.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Technology, I guess, like, I'm not going to call them startups, but yeah, you're right. I think they would have slightly smaller teams, slightly smaller revenue.
Yeah. Well, Hewlett Packard, for example, might, you know, a company like that might like you to call them a startup. I don't know.
Well, was it 15 years ago? I think we were talking in the context of Stephen Walker. I don't know what they were back then, but.
Yeah, not a startup. All right. Should we talk about, company revenue?
Look, we've just touched on it, but let's now consider how does company revenue impact the legal department maturity? Because that's what the report goes into quite detail. So large companies with $3 billion in revenue consistently score higher in 14 out of the 15 functions. Then mid-sized companies also tend to score higher. But interestingly, innovation management seems to be the same for small and mid-sized companies. So perhaps innovation is a people thing. I'm not sure. Maybe we'll come back to that. But in terms of the relationship between revenue and maturity, why do we think this is? I mean, I have a few points to kick us off, or maybe like another question. You know, is it because larger sized companies have more money to spend? Larger team, more resources, perhaps higher budget, maybe more appetite for risk. Does that allow things for investment into legal operations functions, legal operations people, technology, et cetera? Is it because there are more bodies, I guess I can call them, FTEs, to drive change? You know, sometimes we talked about change management quite a lot. You need a bit of momentum to get things moving forward. And if you've only got a team of five or six, and out of that five or six, 60 or 70% of them are detractors or even neutrals, it's going to be very, very hard to drive that change. Before I kind of continue with some of my other thoughts, what are your thoughts on those two questions that I've just posed?
Yeah, so I agree with those points. And I think there's also something related but kind of more subtle in a way going on here, which is when you have a larger team compared to a smaller team, not only does the larger team have more resource and in a way that the business case kind of stacks up more, but also there are other issues that come about simply because you have a larger team and you need to have process to do some of the things that a smaller team could do more organically. And so, for example, think about something like knowledge management, right? So sharing knowledge throughout the department. Now, imagine you have a team of, I don't know, two or three people, like a really small team. Well, how do they share knowledge between them? Well, they can, to some degree, just chat with each other. Or maybe they have a little share drive where they put things and they can sort of make sure that they're naming things consistently and they all know what's in there because they literally just probably sit next to each other and can talk to each other about what's going in there. There's a sort of an organic way of sharing that information. But if you scale that up to 200, 300, 400 people, well, you just simply can't do that, right? You can't have that sort of organic sharing anymore. And you actually need to have some kind of resource, process, and structure around knowledge management. And very often that sits in legal ops. So that's a little example of where I think there's a kind of a subtle thing going on, which is not just business case, not just resource, but also you simply just need process to make it happen. Another example here might be change management. You know, we talk about that a lot on this podcast. And again, if you've got a team of two or three people and you're going to introduce a new system, well, you can all sit in a room and talk about it and talk about whether it's a good idea or not, and everyone can have input into how it's going to work and be used by the team. Scale that up to 200, 300, 400 people and you can't do that anymore. You can't get that sort of direct engagement with the whole team, and so you need to find other ways to bring people on the journey that is that change. And so, again, I just think that with larger teams, process becomes more important, and process is often the purview of legal ops. So, yeah, agree with your points, and I would also add that more sort of subtle that more subtle point.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I the other thought that I had is often the size of the prize is something that I kind of talk about quite a lot when you're thinking about putting a business case together for anything, whether it's technology, for new resources, for legal operations functions, whatever it may be. Often the size of the prize is going to play a huge role in whether or not you can push that forward. So I wanted to just kind of provide an example, which is kind of linked to what you're talking about in terms of if you've got three people and you're looking at knowledge management, the problem would be isolated and you can kind of solve it with a bigger team. Almost the problem is compounded by, you know, 200 times, for instance, or 100 times if you've got that many people. But if I take an example of, say, an automated NDA, something very, very simple, the amount of effort to create the tool is going to be the same whether you have a team of 200, 300, or whether it's going to be a team of, say, 20. And the cost of the underlying technology most likely would be the same. If I just take a very simple example of building an NDA tool out of, say, Office 365, the cost is going to be the same again, regardless of the company size and regardless of the team. But if a large team has, let's say, 10 times more people, so let's say it's a small team of 20 and a large team of 200, then the return on investment is going to be 10 times larger. And let me just explain that. If you're building an NDA tool to save, let's say, an hour per week per lawyer for the team, that's 200 hours for a team of 200. But all of a sudden, if you go to a team of 200, then you've got 2,000 hours. So it's a very big difference. And if you've invested the same amount of time, 200 hours might not be enough to get your business case pushed through, but 2,000 hours might be better. And it, you know, they're obviously made up numbers. You'd probably be higher numbers, but I think it's interesting to understand it in that concept. Thinking about the size of the prize, and I think legal teams that are bigger would almost be able to get technology pushed through because the cost of technology for, say, an enterprise management system, for instance, there is a lot of benefit to have, I guess.
Yeah, and you've just explained essentially the theory of economies of scale, which I completely agree with. And I mean, I would say that even if the implementation cost is significantly higher, so say it costs $100 to build that automated NDA tool for a small team, and it costs $500 to build it for the much bigger team, well, it still, the return on investment is going to be much better for the bigger team, assuming the bigger team is, you know, 2-3 people versus 2-400 people. Then you've got a 100 times increase in people, but only a 5 times increase in cost, right? So either way, the return on investment will be higher. And in fact, for bigger teams, you probably will have higher implementation costs because of things like change management and, well, other stuff that's going to increase the cost, but still the return on investment is likely to be higher. So I think we're driving at the same points. Now, shall we talk about some of the specific responses, some of the responses in relation to the specific measures?
Yeah, let's do that. I mean, there are 15 of them, and I think it would take us a very long time to speak about them all. So I want to just dive into ones that I think we've spoke about on this podcast in the past, but also ones that are kind of close to my heart, and I think your heart as well, Elliot. And the first one is change management. And we've talked about it a lot. We've had, I think, 3 or 4 different guests talk about change management. You and I are kind of leading some big implementations of technology, and with that comes a lot of change management. So this is something that's front of mind for us. And the report details that the average maturity state for legal departments at the moment is early stage 2. So that means that, I guess, on average, people are doing quite a lot of stuff. We know that already, but they consider their involvement in change management quite low. And I'll pull out some specific numbers now. So only 6.5% have a standardized process for managing change. Only 12% use project management in major initiatives. And only 12% indicate that both the department and affected clients are systematically informed about change initiatives and feedback sought and addressed throughout. So I guess some of the initial, gut feelings that you hear about technology implementations and other changes that don't go well, I think it obviously has to link to, well, only a very small percentage of people have a deliberate strategy for change management. So, Elliot, why do we think this is? Why do we think that only, like I said, 6.5% have a systemized process for managing change?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of potential answers there, isn't there? On the one hand, if you've got, if you're thinking about the lawyers in the team, I think change management is just not part of most, sort of legal training regimes, particularly at the university level, but also more generally. I just don't think it's something that historically lawyers have seen as being part of their toolkit. So that's one thing. I don't think we're really trained for it. I don't think it's natural for us to think about it. The other thing I would say is that I wonder if change management is just somewhat an amorphous concept. So, and by that I mean, what is it actually? You know, if I'm a lawyer sitting here with some initiative going on to introduce a new process or a new technology, whatever it might be, how do I actually do it? You know, what's part of it? Partly that's because I'm not trained in it, but partly because it just seems to be this kind of fluffy thing that no one can really tell me exactly what it is, right? And I think related to both of those points is that there are a lot of people talking about it, and let's be honest, we're among them. And I think it's easy to get the impression that others are kind of well-versed in it and know what they're doing, and you don't. And I think that's just something that is not true. I mean, if you think back to our interview with Stephen Walker, who does know quite a bit about this, even he was very honest in that interview, saying he doesn't consider himself to be an expert. So I think there's a bit of that going on as well. People thinking, well, I know what this thing is, in a very fuzzy way, but I don't know exactly what's involved in it. And all these other people are talking about it a lot. And so I wonder if I'm really, you know, as good at it as they are. And I think the truth is that, you know, just simply being aware of it as being something that needs focus is a really good start.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's a good point. I guess looking at the other side, because I only mentioned the departments that are doing it. When you look at the kind of the other side of things, so just at the first one that I mentioned, which is around standardized process for managing change, only 6.5%. 43% have nothing in place. So either A, they're not changing at all and, you know, they're going to become obsolete, or two, they are trying to change but have no structured and deliberate strategy to do that, which is, I guess, a little bit concerning. On the last part though, which was the last point which I was talking about, where I said, 12% indicated that the department don't have a process for systematically informing or even, you know, keeping close to the people that are affected by the change. I found that quite interesting, because you don't need to, in my opinion, to be a change manager or a change expert to understand that if you're going to impact certain people, that you want to get their feedback on certain things. And I found that, you know, only 12%, or actually it's 11.3%, closer to 11% of legal departments have that strategy. 42% have it partially in place, which is good, but 25% have nothing in place. So again, either A, they're implementing technology or doing changes and just chucking it in and hoping it works, or they're not doing it at all.
Yeah, and I wonder if one word in that description that is doing a sort of, what's the word I'm looking for, and a greater than might otherwise be necessary amount of work here is the word systematic, because mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's probably a bunch of people out there thinking, well, if I were to be involved in some change project, I would of course do change management, but that doesn't mean I have a systematic way for doing it. So, you know, the question is phrased in a particular way, and I wonder if that is to some degree affecting the results.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I see a distinction between doing change management reactively and having a deliberate plan to focus on change management. And I think that's what that first question was, a standardized process for managing change embedded in all activities. So that's, okay, guys, we're going to implement a piece of technology. Let's plan out what that change looks like, who it's going to impact, who our stakeholders are, what the changes are, do we need to do training, et cetera, as opposed to kind of getting it in and going, oh, actually, we need to talk to these people, get their requirements, and oh, actually, this is going to impact this team a lot, so let's have a chat to them. So maybe a different way of thinking about this is just, are you proactive or reactive in change management?
Yeah, good way to put it.
So just jumping into another one, which is another one that's pretty close to my heart, which is external resource management or resources management, which effectively means vendor management. So that includes both technology vendors, obviously law firms, alternative legal service providers, et cetera. Just to call out a few things. So things that legal departments are doing really well. So sourcing decisions, so deliberate sourcing decisions, and ongoing considerations about who and how they brief their law firms. Use of legal services is driven by value provided at the phase and task level. So I think it's good that I'm not going to say moving away from the hourly-based rate or charge billable hour, but are thinking about how do we get value at a phase level and incentivizing the right behaviors around that. And I guess outside counsel and vendor management are centralized functions within legal operations, which in my opinion is kind of the only way to see real change if you centralize it. What legal departments are not doing well, or at least need to build bench strength in, is the use of alternative fee arrangements. If we're still going to be calling them alternative fees arrangements, or no, should we just be moving to fee arrangements? Systematic process for assessing value. So that's that word again, Elliot, a systematic process, because I think people do assess value, but do they have a strategy or a deliberate approach? Are they reactive or proactive? A standardized supplier quality performance metrics. So are they assessing people objectively based on quantitative data as opposed to qualitative data? Regular structured mutual feedback. Only 11% actually are doing that, or at least say that they have it in place. Vendor management metrics integrated into GC dashboard, which I also found was interesting. And then a systematic use of value add and value enabling capabilities like training and secondments. In my experience has been you spend a lot of time setting up a panel and agreeing to these value add services like technology and secondments or word processing or whatever it may be, and they never get used. And this data directly suggests that only 10% actually have that in place, or at least are using it systematically.
Hey, Alex, just circling back to one thing you said, you mentioned outside counsel and vendor management being centralized functions within legal ops, and that you think that's important. What do you actually mean by that?
Well, I think if you are trying to manage a budget for the legal department, for the entire legal department, but you've got, say, regional GCs trying to manage parts of their budget, they've got their own relationships with particular law firms, and then you've got, say, in a particular region, another region, they may have different relationships. What I see, based on my experience, the power it could be in is, you know, centralizing financial management within a particular group to understand and take advantage of particular opportunities around, say, volume discounts. So an example is, you know, if you've got a firm, if you've got a team in Australia, the US, and say Europe, you might have almost an Australian panel, if you want to call it that. You might have a US panel and you might have a European panel. But you might see that actually we're going to be using 200 different providers this year, and that piece of the pie for each of those providers is quite small. But if you take that away, you centralize it, create some really close relationships with some key providers, let's say 5 or 6 globally, all of a sudden you can increase their size of the pie, which then you can increase your volume discounts, get discounted rates, but also get things like value-added services. So my point was specifically around if you manage your external spend in regional or even pockets, you're not going to be able to see opportunities like that.
Okay, makes sense.
So just another one really quickly, metrics and analytics. And again, the average maturity was intermediate stage 1. I think for metrics and analytics, people recognize there's a lot of room for improvement. There is a well-established automation for integrating dashboards and information. I think that itself needs a lot of improvement. There is lots of data that the team produces, collects, but doesn't have an automated system of integrating and actually visualizing that data. Reports include measures relative to business baselines, benchmarks, and targets. So again, you may be collecting it in a semi-structured way, but you're not giving it context, no KPIs, things like that. And then we look at technology management maturity. So the average maturity here is intermediate stage 1 as well. You know, legal is very much focused on aligning business processes across the enterprise using technology. So only 15% say they actually have that in place, which I find interesting because a lot of teams usually for their first interaction with technology would be a matter management system probably, or a contract management system, which I think would touch almost the entire organization. Majority though say they're planning or partially have it in place. Examples include things like demand intake technologies, NDA technologies, things like that. I think that they're examples of enterprise technology. Only 7% have a longer-term 5-year technology plan, which in my opinion is very hard to create a 5-year technology plan, maybe a 3-year, but there is technology that teams use today that didn't exist 5 years ago. So how would we know what's going to exist later? But anyway, I think that's an entire separate conversation. And the last point is only 5% are looking into AI technologies, but a large proportion have nothing in place. And that is not the team using AI. That is just the team researching how AI could be used within their team. So even though you go to conferences and a lot of the conferences are about technology, teams don't have a deliberate strategy. At least they're saying they don't have a deliberate strategy yet. And they're not integrating very well with or aligning with business processes.
Yeah. And I think the point you make about the 5-year tech plan is a really good one, because I agree with you. That does seem like, you know, a pretty high bar to reach, to have a 5-year plan in place. I suppose the only thing I'd say there is that you could potentially have a plan in place that is solution agnostic, right? So in other words, you could say, well, in 5 years, we intend to have a matter management system and a document management system and an intake tool, without necessarily saying what the particular providers of those services will be, because the providers and the market there very likely, in fact, I'd say certainly will change, but probably you'll need those types of technologies, with, of course, the rider to all that, that there might be something else coming down the track that makes the whole thing obsolete. So yes, agree that is difficult. You probably could do it to some degree. 5 years does seem like a high bar. Yeah. Now, should we talk about best in class? What do the best in class organizations look like, and how have they measured it? This seems to be the kind of drum roll, I think.
Yeah. You know, kick us off.
Yeah, right. So the report also talks about what a best-in-class organization looks like. And there's a few things we should say here in terms of how they've come up with the measure. So we'll get to what that organization does look like. But the first thing is that the ACC has weighted each of the functions the same. So they haven't given any, you know, higher weighting to any particular functions or competencies. And, you know, I think there's a question as to whether you should weight some higher than others, but you know, let's not get into that now. And then the other thing is that a number of functions have rated competencies or, you know, functions as not applicable to them. And so the way the authors of the report have dealt with that is they've just essentially kind of excluded those competencies when measuring the overall maturity of the function. And that is interesting, because you know, if you think about a function that has rated itself very highly across, say, 10 out of the 15 maturities, and that means that 5 of them they've said are not applicable, well, then you are comparing the maturity of that function with the maturity of another function that has rated itself across all 15 of the maturities. Now, I don't know a good way to deal with that, but it does seem to me to create a question around whether you've got, you know, apples versus apples or apples versus oranges. Maybe one way you could deal with that is to say, well, any function that has said that, say, more than 2 or 3 are not applicable, well, they just don't get rated. But then, of course, you reduce the sample size. So I don't have a good solution there, but I do think it's interesting just to note that that's how they've done the calculation. And so the way they've calculated overall maturity is it's essentially just an average. So it's the sum of the scores on the individual competencies divided by the number of competencies that the function rated itself in, just gives you an average. And so according to their data, the top 10%, as in the 10% that had the highest average maturity rating, looked like this. They were a company with at least $9.3 billion in annual revenue. They spend $14.9 million internally, and they spend $28.5 million externally on external legal support. So they spend significantly more externally than internally. And probably not surprisingly, the department has at least one legal ops professional. So I think a lot of that ties back to what we said earlier, which is that the larger companies tend to rate themselves as more mature. The companies that have at least one legal ops professional tend to rate themselves as more mature. None of that, I think, is surprising. I do think that split between internal and external is interesting, although, again, not surprising.
Yeah, well, I mean, this raises a question as to, do you need to be a large legal team to have a mature operating model? I personally think the answer is no, but we've talked about a lot of the issues with why that could be the case. But I just find it interesting that the mature companies that have $9.3 billion in company revenue, I think the average size of a legal team is proportioned to, I think it's 0.2 or 0.3% of the company's revenue. So that's how much it would spend. And that's kind of how that 14 internally and 28 externally. So the internally is obviously FTEs. So I think this is basically saying, if you've got a larger team, you have a better chance of being mature. But I guess on the other side is, if you're a smaller team and a smaller company, your operational maturity is not going to be up to scratch. So Elliot, you've kind of just touched on a few of the kind of key survey takeaways, and that's, you know, obviously legal ops professionals make a difference. Not all functions are equal, size matters. But kind of the last one I just wanted to quickly mention was that, you know, even the best in class have room to grow. So there's absolutely, based on the data, no clear leaders. So no department recorded an advanced stage of maturity in all 15 functions. So I guess if you conclude that the ACC's maturity model is the model to measure against, then you would have to conclude also that nobody is going to be, or is, sorry, advanced or at least leading the charge at this point, which I thought was quite interesting.
Now, I also just want to make a sort of much higher level point here right at the end, which is that I do think, and actually we've already touched on this, I do think these surveys and the responses to these surveys are highly subjective. There is an attempt in the way they communicate the questions to outline what advanced or intermediate or early stage looks like. But nevertheless, I do think that someone completing the survey, there is room to be subjective in the way that you respond. And I don't think that makes the survey useless, but I do think it means that the survey is actually measuring something different to organizational maturity. And in my opinion, what the survey is really measuring is the perception of maturity rather than maturity itself. So interesting to note that one way to make the results for an organization more mature would be to make the maturity of the function more mature. Another way to make the survey results more mature would be to improve the perception of maturity. So, you know, you might do, for example, internal branding or advertising work to try to make the perception of the maturity of the function more mature. I'm not necessarily advocating that, but I think that is a possibility. And actually, this is probably a segue into, or this is a good place at which to mention change management again, because I think the better change is managed, the more positive will be the engagement of the wider team with change initiatives, and the more likely that team is to think that they have a mature function. So, yeah, I think it's just interesting to note that, you know, this report is really measuring perception rather than actual organizational maturity.
I think that's a great point. I mean, Legal Operations Maturity Benchmarking Report, innately it is subjective. And I guess you're trying to subjectively measure against something that is objective. And as you've kind of just alluded to, it's very hard to think about perception and then measure it against someone else's perception, because it's obviously going to be subjective. So perhaps what we need here is more objective measures. So moving away from qualitative, which I think a lot of these questions would, even though there were some quantitative ones, we need to somehow create a version that allows people to directly measure against a particular benchmark from a quantitative perspective. So there are obviously other benchmarking reports that, based on financial management, for instance, there is, you know, an average amount of providers for, let's say, IP. That is kind of a quantitative. You can measure directly against that, whereas perception, like you said, is subjective. So it doesn't make this report useless at all. I think it's great to give this almost like a pulse on the legal industry, but it is, I think, like you said, going to be subjective.
Yep, agreed. All right, well, we hope people have found that useful. As we said earlier, well worth downloading the report and reading it in detail. It's full of fantastic, interesting insights. And thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time. If you've enjoyed this discussion, please subscribe. And if you'd like to support the podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or your favourite podcast app. And please share a link to the podcast with your friends and colleagues via LinkedIn or other social media. And thanks for listening.